Hey, good day, and welcome to another exciting episode of, I'm going to say it right, it's the OIG Roundtable. Because even though it's not a roundtable, there are at least three of us, which makes it a roundtable. Again, I am Eric Rubenstein. I am the Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse here at Advise Health. I am a retired senior special agent from the OIG out of the New York, New Jersey area. And I am joined, we're short Wade McFall. Wade's got another assignment that has precluded him from being part of today, but I've got my two compadres, Jason Isegrun, retired senior executive from the OIG and the former director of the UPIC West. And I've got Matt Kachansky, the younger, more attractive version of Jason, also senior executive from the OIG, retired, went on to run the Northeast UPIC. And this actually is a good one because today what we want to talk about for the next 20 or 30 minutes is we want to talk about fraud is local. All fraud is local, even when it percolates nationally. And it's kind of fortuitous that we're going to talk about that because Jason was the West Coast guy, Matt's the East Coast guy. And so there were going to be some nuances to what the fraud schemes were in those parts of the country. And then, what was happening in the Northeast versus the Southeast and, different parts of the country. What got me thinking about this as a topic, guys, is the fact that, let's start with sort of the base, which is Strikeforce. 2007, the Strikeforce was established, HEAT as they called it, or the Strikeforce. There's currently now, I think, 14 or 15 Strikeforce cities, plus the two opioid task forces or Strikeforces, right? So we've got 14 or 15 Strikeforces around the country. Some of them are regional, like when Miami started, it was really South Florida. And then in 2018 or so, when they brought in the strike force to New Jersey, they determined that the entire state of New Jersey had a problem versus just a particular zip code. And having worked in New Jersey most of my career, I wholeheartedly agreed with that. But for the most part, these become regional things. And when the strike force started in Miami in 2007, the thrust was low-hanging fruit. I think that continues to be part of what the strike force's mantra is because it's very heavily data-driven. And so when you look at the data, you can kind of see where a lot of the malfeasance occurs, particularly for those that are on the fraud side. And, when the Miami strike force started, they were able to identify a lot of fraud, particularly in the DME world, things like, DME suppliers who had been billing for millions of dollars. The address of record was a dirt lot. So it wasn't even a physical location. And most of the beneficiaries who were part of the target were people who were of the same or similar cultural organization or, the same kind of cultural background. Jason, you had something you wanted to say early on. Go ahead. I like the hand raising.
Well, I just thought it would be directly relevant to what you're talking about with the strike forces. So I would just encourage everyone to look at a map of the strike forces and you'd see west of the Mississippi, it's Southern California, and that's it. It's hard to believe that the data doesn't exist to support, for instance, in Phoenix, which has become the fifth largest city. It's a huge healthcare center. I think there's other things that go into the analysis is what I would suggest.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. I mean, and we can talk about that towards the end, but that then falls into sort of the category of things that we've talked about a lot when we talk about SIU management is resource allocation, right? It's why do cases take so long? Why do cases languish? Why are there difficulties in this thing or that thing? And a lot of it is resource allocation. So is the expansion of Strikeforce to a city like Phoenix or the, something other than Southern California, is it a resource allocation issue? The office in Phoenix, the OIG office at least, is small. I think there's only three or four agents in that office. It's not a center of healthcare fraud investigations like a New York or even New Jersey, which is now up to, I think, 10 or 11, agents around the country. So that's certainly, something to consider. But so let's start with you, Jason, because since we're talking about, West Coast and give me 1 minute just to kind of wrap up the theory on, on the strike forces. When they moved when the strike force started in Miami, the next place it went to was Brooklyn, Eastern District of New York. And the attempt was to bring the same data analytic model and the same investigative kind of roadmap that was being followed in Miami to Brooklyn. And I think what we quickly learned was that the while the fraud schemes may have been similar in the sense that there was a lot of DME fraud, a lot of things with orthotics, a lot of things, you know, in that world. And we'll talk a little bit about the, you know, then they moved on to PT, OT and the like. The major difference outside of the fact that a different cultural group was being targeted in Brooklyn, the biggest difference was if you drove by the address of record for the supplier or the physical therapy location, whatever, it was an actual place. And so the biggest stumbling block in getting cases done early on in the New York strike force in Brooklyn was it wasn't like, hey, this is a dirt lot. This has to be entirely bullshit. Is that it was way beyond that. It was you had an actual building with services being rendered inside of that building. And, you know, what we learned in some of those investigations was the beneficiaries were very clearly part and parcel to those fraud schemes. There's one case in particular in which there was a sign in a room in the back of the building where when the beneficiary was being given their kickback for the allowance of their Medicare number to be used, that there was a sign, a poster in Russian of an older Russian woman wearing, you know, kind of the do-rag or whatever they call that, the shmata, as the old Yiddish women would say. And she's like this, you know, sort of loose lips sink ships kind of a thing. And that obviously presents a situation because it makes it very difficult to investigate a case when you have a kickback case in which someone isn't willing to tell on themselves, right? So the model of the data is able to move and morph, but sometimes the investigative techniques, you know, have to change. But, you know, I think it really is that the fraud schemes become local in the sense that how you tackle the fraud, how you investigate it, and the resources that you're going to use are going to have to ebb and flow. You know, in New York, it was very important for us to identify agents that spoke languages that were going to be needed for conversations with people in those areas. And, you know, I think that that's an important piece of the puzzle on how you make that those investigations local. But Jason, I want to go to you because since we started, since you talked a little bit about West Coast and Phoenix, you know, and we know from talking to you a number of times on these kinds of topics, there are, you know, thousands of hospices around the country. But for some reason, I'm going to say it's because if you're going to die, you might as well try to die in a place where the weather is nice, that most of or the largest percentage of hospices happen to be in Southern California. So what, let's talk a little about that. What do you think makes for that to be a fact? And then really the other piece of it is, how do you tackle something that is a very, very, it's a niche area of healthcare. So you know, where there aren't a lot of hospices necessarily around the country where cases are just kind of always coming up, in the Western jurisdiction of the UPIC, hospice was a staple of the investigative world that the UPIC encountered, right?
Yes. Density of population plays a big role in it, but there obviously are other factors that would be a whole long conversation beyond this, meaning that there are other places other than Southern California where there's a dense population. So for instance, you know, and I'm not suggesting that it isn't a problem in the major areas like the greater New York area or something like that, but it is, it does stick out like a sore thumb in terms of being a problem in Southern California. And I hate to have my perseverant behavior take over, but that's kind of my point of about the strike forces. And I think the strike force is a great model. I think anytime you can have a focused resource on something, you know, you're not relearning that type of investigation and prosecution over and over again. You have, you're developing sources of information, investigative measures and things of that nature that you can replicate. So, all, you know, the model is great, but why is it that there isn't a strike force potentially for certain subject matter areas like hospice, for instance? It's such a politically sensitive and a much needed service. I mean, anyone and probably everyone that would be listening to this has had some experience, a relative or something like that, with hospice. And when you engage hospice, it's so important to the healthcare process. And then to have it be bastardized and become a, you know, a way of making money illicitly is pretty horrible. And I know that sounds a little trite, but it just is. Long and short of it is that there needs to be that focused attention to certain areas. But to the point of this podcast, which is All Fraud is Local, it's really interesting that it's very prevalent in Southern California. And we, you know, before we got started, we were talking a little bit about DME. And we said something about, you know, well, what changes? And I mentioned, well, the zip codes change. Well, in the 90s, you know, you would think that all the DME in the United States was being dispensed out of about three or four zip codes in Brooklyn, New York. And now that has all shifted, and it's, you know, and there are different pockets. So seeing that where those pockets are, it's not static, it's dynamic. And so my, you know, I'll use the strike force again as an example. So I'm not doubting the data, but I haven't seen the data personally, so I can't really comment on it. But really, like, so Baton Rouge, it deserves a strike force, but not Phoenix, Arizona. I would suggest that there are other things going on that are driving why there's a strike force in those places. And hopefully, you know, the Department of Justice does take on a reevaluation of where they need to have those focused, highly successful resources in the future.
Well, so you bring up a good point. And Matt, before I turn it over to you, you know, we talked in the hospice world. So, you know, I was recently interviewed for an article that ProPublica magazine did regarding hospice. I was on a podcast involving hospice. Matt was recently on that same podcast, The Whistleblower Show. And, you know, the prevailing question is, why isn't CMS doing more to stop the hospice fraud? And I said, well, you know, my opinion is you have to talk to CMS. That's first and foremost. But understanding that just from an optics perspective, the word hospice does not elicit happy, joyful thoughts, right? It's not like, oh, I'm going to the doctor to get this frown, you know, this brow line taken care of by Botox. Happy, positive thought. Whenever there's a discussion about hospice, it's end of life. It's doom and gloom. And so to have this conversation about hospice becomes a hot button topic regardless. And so part of it is understanding, like, what is really the fraud scheme that's out there, and how do you make it a less politicized discussion, and how do you make it less of a medical ethics conversation and less of a social issue and more of a fraud issue. So, you know, whenever I'm asked that question, why doesn't CMS do more? The question kind of is, well, what more do you do about a topic that is so hot button, right? So hot button. And there are things, you know, that could be done. For example, if no one has ever had a diagnosis of stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and all of a sudden hospice is sending claims for someone with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and there's not been a history of diagnostic testing, visits with an endocrinologist or a oncologist or a hematologist or anything like that, those are things that raise a flag, right? That someone should say, hey, the data speaks for itself. And we talk a lot about that, you know, like the data speaking for itself. So, you know, we could probably talk for hours and days about why hospice fraud is prevalent. I think for our purposes, the interesting piece is when we talk about fraud being local, for the western part of Southern California, for the Southern California part, the west part of the country, it's really because of the geographics of it that most hospices happen to be there. And I would surmise, look, if I lived in Wade's part of town, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and it's, you know, summer is July 12th, and it's miserable and it's cold and I'm on my deathbed, do I want to die in a place where the weather's nice? I mean, maybe that's the metric. I don't know, but maybe that is part of that. So Matt, I want to go to you because so two things. One, you spent your career at the OIG in the Mid-Atlantic region, right? Northeast. You spent a lot of time dealing with the Northeast agents and the Northeast regions, 1, 2, 3, which is Boston, New York, and the DC, area, Philly area. And then you were the CMS liaison for a while. Then you went on to the UPIC, and particularly most, recently when you were at the Northeast UPIC, it's 12 or 14 states, all the way through to the, below the Mason-Dixon line, which is actually in New Jersey, but everybody feels like it's in Virginia. So you're seeing frauds that are substantially different, whereas, we wouldn't really see a lot of hospice cases in the Northeast. We would see a lot of, telemedicine fraud. The genetic testing was a huge piece of the puzzle on that. So, what are your thoughts on, it is local, but there are national implications to this.
Sure. Let's start with the genetic testing. We had a lot of it in the Northeast UPIC region, largely because the MACs there did not have the edits in place that were stopping the claims. So, and Jason, you could talk about this, if I'm getting something wrong, but a lot of the labs out on the West Coast where the MACs did have the edits in place, they would use the labs on the East Coast to be their reference labs, would send the tests to those labs. They'd run them there, bill the MACs on the East Coast for the test, and then kick back some of the money back to the labs on the West Coast because they generated the actual referrals. And that's simply because the coverage limitations were uneven across the country. So the fraud was local, but the problem was national. I think I captured that right.
Yeah. So that's really a great point. And so what really I think the heart of what you're getting to, Matt, and please correct me if I'm misinterpreting this, is, but part of this metric is, in the absence of an NCD, National Coverage Determination, in which individual MACs can come up with their own policy, which is known as the LCD or the LCAs in some regards, that when you've got this, breakup of the system where individual MACs can create a policy or an edit to pay or not pay for something based upon some regional norm, for lack of a better term, that you've got that situation. So you've got potentially, and this is really almost no different than the telemedicine fraud schemes involving DME and the compounds when they were going on, is that the marketers are driving the scripts and the marketers are identifying where the best bang for the buck is, meaning where can I get the highest commission for what I'm doing? Where is the highest reimbursement going to come? And even before that, where is the reimbursement going to come? Where's the highest reimbursement going to come? And where am I going to get the path of least resistance? Meaning, if one of the MACs in the Northeast jurisdiction has an edit in place that they're not going to pay for this group of codes because they are considered to be either experimental or what have you, or it's not whatever the coverage is going to be, but then you've got a MAC in another jurisdiction that is silent on that, well, where are all those samples going to go? You're just going to find a lab that operates in that jurisdiction, because keeping in mind that claims get submitted where the service is rendered. So if it's a lab in New York and the patient is in California, the lab in New York is getting billed, not the MAC in California. And so, there really can be this Boolean logic kind of methodology where the reps who are driving a lot of these scripts are doing it, or the sales reps are able to extend their reach to say, hey, guess what, Dr. Smith, if you were to swab your patient and send it to this lab, it's not going to get paid because they have a policy for non-payment. But in this other place, it will be. So if you coordinate with me, I can get that swab taken care of. Where I think that becomes a bigger problem is when you actually have a case that goes to the mat where a provider chooses to take a case like that to trial. And I remember having a case like that when I first transferred to New Jersey. I had a case involving a podiatrist who had an office in New Jersey and an office in Pennsylvania. And I talked about this when we did our podiatry fraud, and I think this really does bring it home, is that one MAC had an LCD that wouldn't pay for a service. One MAC had an LCD that didn't have an LCD. It was silent on it. Now, he was committing a fraud, so it kind of went beyond that. But if this was something that was maybe civil in nature, you can certainly see an argument, particularly when you have a jury of people who believe that the Medicare program is a national program. What people don't really believe understand is that Medicare is a nationally administered program, but it is locally, you know, it's locally administered. It's a nationally created program. It's locally administered. And I think that's really where we get kind of to the heart of all fraud being local, is that, you know, the wayward provider community is very smart, right? The people that we talk to aren't, this is for the people that are trying to do the right thing, the people that are in maybe the waste and abuse piece, not necessarily the fraudulent piece, but, you know, that ability to move and morph, you know, to that, you know, is really part of it. So Jason, I want to close out because we're kind of running out of time, but, you know, at the UPIC, you're relying upon a combination of NCDs and LCDs in helping to shape an overpayment or a referral to law enforcement, right? Because there's a reliance upon you can't just say this isn't covered because, right? It's a denied service, and it's based on statute, policy, regulation, something. When you're working on these things at the UPIC level and you're finding these cases that transcend your traditional jurisdictional boundary of the Western UPIC or from out the Northeast, how do you account for the potential divergence in the prospect of you're on the West Coast, your team is working on a case that's a West Coast case, but the policies that are implicated are not within the jurisdiction of the West Coast? Like, yeah, how do you reconcile that and make it local?
Well, first,
kudos. You transfer those things to me.
That may be true too.
First, though, I want to offer kudos to our host, whose master's prepared with a reference to a Boolean search. So yeah, like we can all Google that later. You know, I will say this, that it is a little bit not responsive to your question, but it's playing in my head. Over the weekend, I rewatched a movie, Catch Me If You Can, about Frank Abagnale, and he's a check fraudster premier. And the reality is he turned that into a lifelong career in providing security for the checks. I mean, frankly, what a great resource it would be to find out what fraudsters are focusing on and why, and look for those weaknesses and then apply them to the other areas that match that locale. So for instance, in Florida, you know, Florida was having a serious problem in the Medicaid realm where they were billing for hospital services after that started out as an emergency, but then became non-emergent. And the OIG did a great report. Frankly, it was the Office of Evaluations and Inspections that did a report on that matter. And as back then the Medicaid integrity contractor in Florida, we took a look at that and had some very successful recoveries as a result of that. So looking at what is the genesis of the weakness that, or what was the weakness that was the genesis of that problem, would allow us to focus a little bit more. But, you know, in terms of how do you apply the resources, it's all data driven, and it's just such, well, this is going to be a little bit of an old guy thing, but I'm sure, Eric, you can remember probably back when you first started having these 8 volumes of 8 to 10 inch thick pinprinted printouts of Medicare claims, and trying to make some heads or tails of it with a highlighter and a Sharpie. And it's just so, you know, 20th century that it's why, you know, we're not in that place now. And so it's going to all be data driven, you know, and it can start with as simple as a spike analysis, frankly, and then look at, well, why is that spike happening? And so it's oftentimes those very rudimentary efforts that start the process of then digging deeper into it. And COVID is an example of that. The COVID claims now, the attributes that are driving ferreting out that type of fraud, you know, it's much like even a deeper dive of a look at the data is the bottom line.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. So look, you know, we're out of time on this session. We could really talk about this stuff for hours, really. I mean, if we really wanted to break this out and get out a map and take a look and see like really what frauds occur in what places, I think you're going to see that it is for everything that there's a commonality, there's also a disproportionate number of cases that are in some areas versus others. So it really is local. And I think that's why it's important that people that are in SIUs meet and talk and you know, get involved in working groups, because it's not just about what makes a good referral or a good case, but it's understanding what are the frauds in your neighborhood and are those frauds moving into your neighborhood? You know, have we just done something about it? I mean, a little bit, you know, there's this criminological theory from a professor named James Fox called Broken Windows. I think it's James Fox. And it's the Broken Windows theory. And it's like, if you don't fix the small problems, quality of life, these things get worse. If you're in a payer space and you're not really addressing these kind of smaller things that pop up when they're just a waste abuse issue, they then kind of percolate themselves up into worse and bigger problems. So it's like, you can't just keep putting your finger in the dike because it just, you know, it moves. You got to kind of understand what's coming your way and how can you address it. So, you know, as always, I really do appreciate the insight that you guys have, both from the investigative perspective, your UPIC directorships, and then back to doing, you know, the kind of things that you like doing, which is providing consultative work and investigations on the work that we do today. So good having you. Again, thanks everybody for clicking on the link and tuning in to this podcast, the OIG Roundtable. We got a whole bunch of stuff coming up. A LinkedIn Live in this month in March, myself and attorney Robert Lyles are going to be doing a conversation on the UPICs. We're really going to be talking about NCDs, LCDs, strict liability. It's all going to be part of that. We're looking forward to that one. Jason, Matt, and I, next week on the 8th, the 9th rather, we're going to be out in San Diego at the ABA Health Law Section conversation. They're having a two-day conference. We're going to be speaking about OIG trends and things, all things OIG fraud, waste, and abuse for the ABA out in San Diego. So if you're going to be there, come over and say hello to us. We'd love to say hello to you as well. As always, if you're not getting our newsletter, feel free to shoot us an email at hello@advize.com. We can sign you up for that newsletter and keep up with all of the great things that are happening here at Advize. So as always, Matt, Jason, good to see you. Look forward to seeing you guys in person next week. Thanks to everybody again. We'll see you on the next one.
Thank you all.